Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Welcome to the OIS Energy Transition Programme podcast. My name is David Ledesma, and I'm Distinguished Research Fellow at the Institute. It's my great pleasure to be joined today by Ralph Dickel, who's Senior Visiting Research Fellow at the Institute. And we're here today to discuss his paper, Cross-Border Cooperation on CO2 Transport and Sequestration, The Case of Germany and Norway, that was published in September 2022. Now, just to timestamp this recording, we're recording the podcast on the afternoon of Monday, the 6th of March, 2023. Ralph, welcome to the OIS podcast series.
Well, David, many thanks for having me here at this podcast.
Excellent. Well, look, why don't we start kind of at the top, as they say, you know? What do you think the need is for CO2 sequestration to reach the climate targets?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And indeed, kind of we are facing two challenges. One challenge is that we are 8 billion people now and 10 billion in 2050, and all of them want to have access to reliable energy. That is on one side. On the other side, if we continue to emit carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, we will face increasing disasters. Now, that has been addressed by the IPCC, and the IPCC has come up with a warning that we should stay below 1.5 degrees Celsius, and also with an assessment that this corresponds to a certain carbon dioxide budget left, which was assessed in 2015 to be 500 to 700 billion tons of carbon dioxide. Now, out of that, we are using about 35 billion per year. That means not much is left, and we really have to hurry up to get to a carbon neutral world. Now, if you want to have carbon neutral energy or carbon dioxide neutral energy, there are basically two ways. One way is you avoid carbon dioxide, the creation of carbon dioxide, and the other way is you avoid that carbon dioxide is emitted into the atmosphere. As of now, we have about 80% of fossil fuel in our primary energy mix worldwide, 20% which are carbon dioxide free. Now, it seems to be almost impossible to increase that share by 2000 and by mid-century to 100%. So basically, we have to use both ways to avoid carbon dioxide by renewables, saving, and maybe also nuclear, and on the other hand, to decarbonize fossil fuels. And if you want to decarbonize fossil fuels, then you have to do something with the carbon dioxide, and that means basically you have to sequester it somewhere in the soil. And on top of that, the energetic use, we also have other processes which produce carbon dioxide inevitably, which we also have to get rid of. So there's indeed an absolute need for carbon dioxide for various reasons.
Okay, Ralph, so in your view now, is CO2 sequestration safe? And indeed, is it effective?
Well, first of all, safe. I mean, so far in all the industrial applications of carbon dioxide sequestration, there was no leakage, so in that regard, it's safe. Carbon dioxide handling, transport, and capture is also safe, even though one has to, unfortunately, notice that 2 years ago there was an accident at a carbon dioxide transportation pipeline which burst and where several people had to go to the hospital. Also, they were released after a few hours. Well, with regard to effectiveness, I mean, so far, yes, it is effective. The carbon dioxide has remained in the ground. There are no traces of carbon dioxide coming to the surface, and it's traced by seismic. And we have models how to understand how the carbon dioxide is behaving in reservoirs. So we have two ways to sequester carbon dioxide. One is in depleted fields or in aquifers, and that is just sequestration per se, and then it should stay in the ground and nothing happens. And the other one is enhanced oil recovery with carbon dioxide, which is somewhat different and is applied already for a long time in the US. In both cases, there has been no sign of leakage of carbon dioxide.
So therefore, you know, why does CO2 have to be moved across borders, Ralph?
I mean, unfortunately, if you wish, fossil fuel reserves and oil reserves and gas reserves are disseminated unequally over the world. And so there are resource-owning countries and countries which do not own carbon the resources or hydrocarbon resources and have to import it. Now, if you are a country which doesn't have hydrocarbon resources, then usually you don't have the structures to sequester carbon dioxide. So that means that on balance, so to speak, whatever is exported as hydrocarbons is imported in another country, and then a corresponding amount of carbon dioxide will be freed when the carbon dioxide is burned. Now, as an example, Norway has 2 million barrels of oil per day as a production, out of which maybe 95% are exported. 2 million barrels of oil per day correspond roughly to some 300 million tons of carbon dioxide emission per year, meaning that Norway exports its oil, a little small part of it is it's using by itself, and to some extent it could also sequester whatever carbon dioxide Norway produces, but 95% of the carbon dioxide which comes with Norwegian oil production, for example, is produced as carbon dioxide in other countries which import oil, meaning that they don't have the geological structures usually to sequester carbon dioxide. So by one would assume that countries exporting hydrocarbons must import carbon dioxide to get the balance right, otherwise it would not work out.
Okay, now, Ralph, you know, what therefore has to be considered when exporting or indeed importing CO2?
Now, on the more technical side, I think you have to set certain standards. I mean, standards, for example, for the quality of the carbon dioxide. It has usually to have a minimum content of 95%. You also have to set standards on the pressure of the carbon dioxide transport if you transport it in pipelines. So that is, so to speak, on the pure technical side. Then, of course, at the very end, to get the scheme of reporting right, you have to have a common standard on what you consider to be safe sequestration of carbon dioxide. So let's say if you go back to Norway and Germany or Norway and the EU and Norway would have to agree on a joint standard of what it means to safely sequester carbon dioxide. So that in the very end, the carbon dioxide sequestered in Norway can be credited along the chain to where it originated. That's, of course, very important for the economics to sequester it all along the chain, and also in a way to get, so to speak, the balances of carbon dioxide right in between the countries. Now, proof of long-term sequestration is not that easy, and the emphasis on long-term, I mean, nobody can afford to wait for another half century or so to watch if all of that is really working safely. Even though with the experience that exists, we have experience of more than 30 years in Norway in the Sleipner field, and in the US more than 50 years for enhanced oil recovery to see what happens with carbon dioxide and see what how it works. I mean, basically, it works on several levels. One level is that you have a ceiling of a structure where the carbon dioxide is sequestered, which is tight and which does not release any carbon dioxide. Now, one example of that is natural carbon dioxide reservoirs, which you see in the United States mainly, with several hundred billions of carbon dioxide, which have been safely stored for dozens of millions of years. So this is one way. Another way is that carbon dioxide is sequestered, that it's dissolved in the brine of a reservoir. Another one is that it's withheld by capillary forces in the reservoir. And finally, quite often the carbon dioxide is solidified with the stone of the reservoir. So these are the ways that carbon dioxide is safely retained. All of that is well known and researched, but if you want to have a guarantee that it's lasting long term, then the usual approach is that you have a model to watch what's happening with the carbon dioxide in a reservoir for carbon dioxide, and that the model matches what you observe in reality. And last but not least, if you see signs that the carbon dioxide builds up pressure compared to what you expect it to do, then you would just stop injecting it and look for another part of the reservoir or another structure. That was, for example, done in the Snowbit case, where one structure was pressuring up after a few years, unpredictably, and then it was stopped and another structure was used to sequester the carbon dioxide.
So how much cross-border activity has actually happened so far?
Not much. I mean, the main example of cross-border carbon dioxide transport is in Canada in the Weyburn field, which gets carbon dioxide from the Synfuel plant in North Dakota. That is an easy case because it's an onshore border. Otherwise, offshore borders are restricted by the London Protocol and by Article 6, which basically prohibits to transport carbon dioxide across a border if it's for carbon dioxide sequestration under the sea. That is a bit strange because also sequestration under the sea, for example, the North Sea, has been opened by an amendment to the London Protocol. And Article 6 is also amended, but it's only on the government level, and it waits for ratification by the quorum of member countries, which is far away. And luckily enough, Norway and the Netherlands, with the help of the IEA, have created a scheme which allows the application of this amended Article 6 already now under the provision of provisional application, which is kind of used under the Vienna Convention. And this has also some reporting mechanism, but this is now used between Norway and the Netherlands, and it's hopefully also used between Norway and Germany when the time comes. So across the sea, there's only the transport of carbon dioxide between the Netherlands and Germany, mainly for the food industry and the beverage industry. But these are very small volumes of carbon dioxide. And there's a project which has been agreed between the Netherlands and Norway to export carbon dioxide from the ammonia plant in the Netherlands to sequestration in Norway. These are the main cases I'm aware of which go cross-border.
So, Ralph, what are the costs of sequestration, and you know, who pays, and actually perhaps who should pay then?
Okay, let's start with the costs, which is already a challenge, but there was a large report in the United States, which was published about 2 years ago by the National Petroleum Council, which is a government industry organization, which looked basically into all potential carbon dioxide capture cases in the United States plus transport and sequestration, and which came up with a cost curve where it kind of plots the costs, the overall costs of CCS against kind of the number of applications, which is covering some 80% of the point sources in the United States. And that cost curve starts basically around $50 per ton of carbon dioxide for the easy cases where capture is pretty cheap, like in ammonia production, for example. And then it increases, let's say, to 85, what we have seen now also in the IRA, in the 45Q provision, which allows $85 per ton of carbon dioxide as a tax credit. And then it continues basically to $110 per ton of carbon dioxide for three-quarter of the emission in the United States. So that is a cost curve which seems serious, which has been very thoroughly worked out. And also the assessment in the EU is of a similar order of magnitude. So €100 per ton of carbon dioxide seems to be a good guess for the next years to go. And the next question is who should pay for it? Well, basically, always either the consumer or the taxpayer. And then the question is if it's a question of fairness or is it a question of effectiveness of the scheme? Now, basically, from my time at the IEA, I recall that there are three ways to deal with this kind of who pays for pollution or how to organize reduction of pollution. One thing is that you impose standards. That means that basically the consumer pays because the costs for meeting the standards are carried on to the consumer. The second point is what's called PIGU taxes, meaning that you create a tax which somehow reflects the damage done by the pollutant. And that is also in the very end paid by the consumer. And then the last point is cap and trade, which is also more or less paid by the consumer, even though it's maybe more market or competition mechanism in between. And then, of course, you always have the old-fashioned subsidies. And as we see, the United States is basically recurring to subsidies because tax credit means subsidy in the United States. It's not a credit you have to repay. And in a rather intelligent way, I mean, you move along the cost curve and you give subsidies to foster, let's say, the first 10% of the cases, and then the next 10%. And by that, you also encourage, so to speak, real-life experience with the technology, and in the hope that you have some learning effect that you bring down the cost curve. Of course, kind of that way is quite efficient and effective, because as an industry, once you have done your paperwork with the government, and you're sure that you get the subsidy, you can go to a bank and ask for financing. If you do it like in the EU, which for many, many reasons is different than the United States, but then basically it's more like a penalty and you have to earn the penalty in the market. As a steel producer, for example, then you produce steel at higher costs because it's then kind of green or carbon dioxide free steel, but then you have to kind of impose it on your customers, and you don't know to which extent you succeed with the customers and against your competitors, and then it will be much more difficult to get a loan from your bank. So it seems that right now the US have a more pragmatic approach, which is also easy because they have kind of a uniform tax system. Others have the structure for carbon dioxide sequestration on their own soil, and in general, they're a bit more pragmatic when it comes to collaboration with industry.
So, Ralph, can you perhaps share with our listeners more details on the examples of cross-border movements of CO2? You know, Norway, Germany, or maybe Japan, Arab states. Can you perhaps tell us more about that?
Arab states and Japan, you would have to move carbon dioxide by ship. There's no other way. And there seem to be some interesting schemes coming up. And some interesting ideas, for example, to use LPG tankers, which transport LPG to Japan, and on the return voyage, they could take carbon dioxide because kind of the tankers are dual-use tankers, or many tankers are dual-use tankers, which can be used for LPG and for carbon dioxide, and then you would have to sequester it in the Arab state. So that seems to be an interesting scheme. But to my knowledge, that's pretty much at the beginning. And unfortunately, also Norway and Germany is also a bit at the beginning. But we have on the 6th of January this year, there was several cooperation projects announced, starting with a somewhat larger framework for cooperation on climate change. But also two more concrete projects are investigated. One is producing blue hydrogen in Karstel on the Norwegian coastline, and then sequester the resulting carbon dioxide on the Norwegian shelf. Thereby, carbon dioxide is not transported cross border, but Germany or maybe the Netherlands would get hydrogen from Norway via a 600-700 kilometer long pipeline, and then it would be used in the hydrogen cluster, which is developing in the northwest of Germany and also on the Dutch side. So that is one project to look into. And another project is to look into a carbon dioxide export scheme from Germany to Norway, which includes both elements. Probably to start with, transport by tankers to a place in Norway, and from there, transport by a spur line to the Norwegian shelf, and then sequestering it via subsea templates into some aquifer structure. And also there is the idea of a somewhat larger scheme for carbon dioxide export pipeline to the Norwegian shelf, to somewhere in the north, maybe north of the Sleipner field in that region. and then to see how you could have a larger scale export and sequestration scheme for carbon dioxide. Again, reminding of the volumes that we are talking about, when Norway would fulfill something like the corresponding commitment, like a scope 3 commitment, that means that they take care of the carbon dioxide which is produced by the oil they export and the gas they export, then they would have to sequester several hundred million tons of carbon dioxide per year. And basically Germany would be the best fit to get carbon dioxide from. First, because Germany has such a large carbon dioxide production and is also increasingly willing to export it. Second, because Germany has limited possibilities geologically to sequester it, and by the legislation for the time being, it's not possible. Other countries, like for example the UK, they would also produce large amounts of carbon dioxide, but they have their own scheme on their own shelf. So they would probably not export large volumes to Norway, but handle it within their own country.
Well, Ralph, why don't we kind of finish off by asking perhaps a more generic question, you know, on kind of the perspectives for greater German-Norwegian cooperation, which could, of course, lead to greater cross-border movements. You know, what's your view on that?
Again, as I mentioned, so to speak, Norway and Germany are a very good fit when it comes to carbon dioxide emissions to be exported to another country. And Norway, which has the potential and maybe also a scope 3 duty to import carbon dioxide and to sequester it. And Norway and Germany have quite a long history of cooperation, which started in the 80s with the Troll project. Large parts of that were exported to Germany, but also to other Northwest European countries. And that worked very well. Norway was building a new infrastructure, which was 4 large pipelines to the continent and also 2 pipelines to UK to export gas. And that was happening within 15 years. So that is a time frame which corresponds to what we face for carbon dioxide sequestration. And on the other hand, Germany, when it comes to capture of pollutants from exhaust streams, within 2 decades was retrofitting all power plants with desulfurization. So within the time from mid-70s to mid-90s, all power plants, except for very, very old ones, and even some of them were retrofitted with sulfur desulfurization, which is a technical process which is similar to absorbing carbon dioxide from power plant processes. When it comes to production of blue hydrogen, there technology is well known. I mean, that is autothermal reforming, and basically it just has to be a bit optimized and adjusted to produce the quality of carbon dioxide to be transported then on to Norway. So one could be, in my mind, quite optimistic that this cooperation will develop and to the benefit basically of both countries.
Well, I have to say, I think we all should be optimistic, because such cooperation, such movements shows the kind of the way we can see the European gas market developing over the coming years. Well, Ralph, you know, thank you so much for your time today and indeed your insights on your paper, Cross-Border Cooperation on CO2 Transport and Sequestration, The Case of Germany and Norway, that was published in September 2022 by the OIES. I hope you've all enjoyed listening to this podcast. Thank you and goodbye to everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as our original research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our energy transition, gas, oil, electricity, or China research programs, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.